I'm the leader of the caravan, said the dark-eyed, bearded man. I hold the power of life and death for every person I take with me. The desert is a capricious lady, and sometimes she drives men crazy. There were almost 200 people gathered there, and 400 animals, camels, horses, mules, and fowl. In the crowd were women, children, and a number of men with swords at their belts and rifles slung on their shoulders. The Englishman had several suitcases filled with books. There was a babble of noise, and the leader had to repeat himself several times for everyone to understand what he was saying. There are a lot of different people here, and each has his own god. But the only god I serve is Allah, and in his name I swear that I will do everything possible once again to win out over the desert. But I want each and every one of you to swear by the god you believe in that you will follow my orders no matter what. In the desert, disobedience means death. There was a murmur from the crowd. Each was swearing quietly to his or her own god. The boy swore to Jesus Christ. The Englishman said nothing, and the murmur lasted longer than a simple vow would have. The people were also praying to heaven for protection. A long note was sounded on a bugle, and everyone mounted up. The boy and the Englishman had bought camels and climbed uncertainly onto their backs. The boy felt sorry for the Englishman's camel, loaded down as he was with the cases of books. "There's no such thing as coincidence," said the Englishman, picking up the conversation where it had been interrupted in the warehouse. "I'm here because a friend of mine heard of an Arab who..." But the caravan began to move, and it was impossible to hear what the Englishman was saying. The boy knew what he was about to describe, though. The mysterious chain that links one thing to another, the same chain that had caused him to become a shepherd, that had caused his recurring dream, that had brought him to a city near Africa to find a king, and to be robbed in order to meet a crystal merchant, and the closer one gets to realizing his personal legend, the more that personal legend becomes his true reason for being, thought the boy. The caravan moved toward the east. It traveled during the morning, halted when the sun was at its strongest, and resumed late in the afternoon. The boy spoke very little with the Englishman, who spent most of his time with his books. The boy observed in silence the progress of the animals and people across the desert. Now everything was quite different from how it was that day they'd set out. Then there had been confusion and shouting, the cries of children and the whinnying of animals, all mixed with the nervous orders of the guides and the merchants. But in the desert, there was only the sound of the eternal wind and of the hoofbeats of the animals. Even the guides spoke very little to one another.
"I've crossed these sands many times," said one of the camel drivers one night. "But the desert is so huge and the horizon so distant that they make a person feel small, as if he should remain silent."
The boy understood intuitively what he meant, even without ever having set foot in the desert before. Whenever he saw the sea or a fire, he fell silent, impressed by their elemental force. "I've learned things from the sheep, and I've learned things from crystal," he thought. "I can learn something from the desert, too. It seems old and wise." The wind never stopped, and the boy remembered the day he had sat at the fort in Tarifa with this same wind blowing in his face. It reminded him of the wool from his sheep who were now seeking food and water in the fields of Andalusia, as they always had. "But they're not my sheep anymore," he said to himself without nostalgia. "They must be used to their new shepherd, and have probably already forgotten me. That's good." Creatures, like the sheep that are used to travelling, know about moving on. He thought of the merchant's daughter, and was sure that she had probably married, perhaps to a baker, or to another shepherd who could read and could tell her exciting stories. After all, he probably wasn't the only one. But he was excited at his intuitive understanding of the camel driver's comment. Maybe he was also learning the universal language that deals with the past and the present of all people. Hunches, his mother used to call them. The boy was beginning to understand that intuition is really a sudden immersion of the soul into the universal current of life, where the histories of all people are connected, and we are able to know everything because it's all written there.
Maktub, the boy said, remembering the crystal merchant.
The desert was all sand in some stretches and rocky in others. When the caravan was blocked by a boulder, it had to go around it. If there was a large rocky area, they had to make a major detour. If the sand was too fine for the animals' hooves, they sought a way where the sand was more substantial. In some places, the ground was covered with the salt of dried-up lakes. The animals balked at such places, and the camel drivers were forced to dismount and unburden their charges. The drivers carried the freight themselves over such treacherous footing, and then reloaded the camels. If a guide were to fall ill or die, the camel drivers would draw lots and appoint a new one. But all this happened for one basic reason. No matter how many detours and adjustments it made, the caravan moved toward the same compass point. Once obstacles were overcome, it returned to its course, sighting on a star that indicated the location of the oasis. When the people saw that star shining in the morning sky, they knew they were on the right course toward water, palm trees, shelter, and other people. It was only the Englishman who was unaware of all this. He was, for the most part, immersed in reading his books. The boy, too, had his book, and he had tried to read it during the first few days of the journey, but he found it much more interesting to observe the caravan and listen to the wind. As soon as he had learned to know his camel better and to establish a relationship with him, he threw the book away. Although the boy had developed a superstition that each time he opened the book he would learn something important, he decided it was an unnecessary burden. He became friendly with the camel driver who travelled alongside him. At night, as they sat around the fire, the boy related to the driver his adventures as a shepherd. During one of these conversations, the driver told of his own life.
"I used to live near El Kairum," he said. "I had my orchard, my children, and a life that would not change at all until I died. One year, when the crop was the best ever, we all went to Mecca, and I satisfied the only unmet obligation in my life. I could die happily, and that made me feel good. One day, the earth began to tremble and the Nile overflowed its banks. It was something I thought could only happen to others, never to me. My neighbors feared they would lose all their olive trees in the flood, and my wife was afraid we would lose our children. I thought that everything I owned would be destroyed. The land was ruined, and I had to find some other way to earn a living, so now I'm a camel driver. But that disaster taught me to understand the word of Allah. People need not fear the unknown if they are capable of achieving what they need and want. We are afraid of losing what we have, whether it's our life or our possessions and property. But this fear evaporates when we understand that our life stories and the history of the world were written by the same hand. Sometimes their caravan met with another. One always had something that the other needed, as if everything were indeed written by one hand. As they sat around the fire, the camel drivers exchanged information about windstorms and told stories about the desert. At other times, mysterious hooded men would appear. They were Bedouins who did surveillance along the caravan route. They provided warnings about thieves and barbarian tribes. They came in silence and departed the same way, dressed in black garments that showed only their eyes. One night, a camel driver came to the fire where the Englishman and the boy were sitting. "There are rumors of tribal wars," he told them. The three fell silent. The boy noted that there was a sense of fear in the air, even though no one said anything. Once again, he was experiencing the language without words, the universal language. The Englishman asked if they were in danger. "Once you get into the desert, there's no going back," said the camel driver. "And when you can't go back, you have to worry only about the best way of moving forward. The rest is up to Allah, including the danger." and he concluded by saying the mysterious word, Maktub.
You should pay more attention to the caravan, the boy said to the Englishman after the camel driver had left. We make a lot of detours, but we're always heading for the same destination.
And you ought to read more about the world, answered the Englishman. Books are like caravans in that respect.
The immense collection of people and animals began to travel faster. The days had always been silent, but now even the nights, when the travellers were accustomed to talking around the fires, had also become quiet. And one day, the leader of the caravan made the decision that the fires should no longer be lighted, so as not to attract attention to the caravan. The travellers adopted the practice of arranging the animals in a circle at night, sleeping together in the centre as protection against the nocturnal cold. And the leader posted armed sentinels at the fringes of the group. The Englishman was unable to sleep one night. He called to the boy, and they took a walk along the dunes surrounding the encampment. There was a full moon, and the boy told the Englishman the story of his life. The Englishman was fascinated with the part about the progress achieved at the crystal shop after the boy began working there.
That's the principle that governs all things, he said. In alchemy, it's called the soul of the world. When you want something with all your heart, that's when you are closest to the soul of the world. It's always a positive force.
He also said that this was not just a human gift, that everything on the face of the earth had a soul, whether mineral, vegetable, or animal, or even just a simple thought.
Everything on earth is being continuously transformed because the earth is alive and it has a soul. We are part of that soul, so we really recognize that it is working for us. But in the crystal shop, you probably realize that even the glasses were collaborating in your success.
The boy thought about that for a while as he looked at the moon and the bleached sands. I've watched the caravan as it crossed the desert, he said. The caravan and the desert speak the same language. And it's for that reason that the desert allows it the crossing. It's going to test the caravan's every step to see if it's in time, and if it is, we will make it to the oasis. If either of us had joined this caravan based only on personal courage, but without understanding that language, this journey would have been much more difficult. They stood there looking at the moon. That's the magic of omens, said the boy. I've seen how the guides read the signs of the desert, and how the soul of the caravan speaks to the soul of the desert.
The Englishman said, I'd better pay more attention to the caravan.
And I'd better read your books, said the boy. They were strange books. They spoke about mercury, salt, dragons, and kings, and he didn't understand any of it. But there was one idea that seemed to repeat itself throughout all the books. All things are the manifestation of one thing only. In one of the books, he learned that the most important text in the literature of alchemy contained only a few lines and had been inscribed on the surface of an emerald.
It's the emerald tablet, said the Englishman, proud that he might teach something to the boy.
Well, then why do we need all these books? The boy asked.
So that we can understand those few lines, the Englishman answered, without appearing really to believe what he said.
The book that most interested the boy told the stories of the famous alchemists. They were men who had dedicated their entire lives to the purification of metals in their laboratories. They believed that if a metal were heated for many years, it would free itself of all its individual properties, and what was left would be the soul of the world. This soul of the world allowed them to understand anything on the face of the earth because it was the language with which all things communicated. They called that discovery the masterwork. It was part liquid and part solid.
Can't you just observe men and omens in order to understand the language? The boy asked.
You have a mania for simplifying everything, answered the Englishman, irritated. Alchemy is a serious discipline. Every step has to be followed exactly as it was followed by the masters.
The boy learned that the liquid part of the masterwork was called the elixir of life, and that it cured all illnesses. It also kept the alchemist from growing old. And the solid part was called the philosopher's stone.
It's not easy to find the philosopher's stone, said the Englishman. The alchemists spent years in their laboratories observing the fire that purified the metals. They spent so much time close to the fire that gradually they gave up the vanities of the world. They discovered that the purification of the metals had led to a purification of themselves.
The boy thought about the crystal merchant. He had said that it was a good thing for the boy to clean the crystal pieces so that he could free himself from negative thoughts. The boy was becoming more and more convinced that alchemy could be learned in one's daily life.
Also, said the Englishman, the Philosopher's Stone has a fascinating property. A small sliver of the stone can transform large quantities of metal into gold.
Having heard that, the boy came even more interested in alchemy. He thought that, with some patience, he'd be able to transform everything into gold. He read the lives of the various people who had succeeded in doing so. Helvetius, Elias, Fulcanelli, and Geber. They were fascinating stories. Each of them lived out his personal legend to the end. They travelled, spoke with wise men, performed miracles for the incredulous, and owned the Philosopher's Stone and the Elixir of Life. But when the boy wanted to learn how to achieve the masterwork, he became completely lost. There were just drawings, coded instructions, and obscure texts.
Why do they make things so complicated? He asked the Englishman one night. The boy had noticed that the Englishman was irritable and missed his books. So that those who have the responsibility for understanding can understand, he said. Imagine if everybody went around transforming lead into gold. Gold would lose its value. It's only those who are persistent and willing to study things deeply who achieve the masterwork. That's why I'm here in the middle of the desert. I'm seeking a true alchemist who will help me to decipher the codes.
When were these books written? The boy asked.
Many centuries ago.
They didn't have the printing press in those days, the boy argued. There was no way for everyone to know about alchemy. Why did they use such strange language with so many drawings? The Englishman didn't answer him directly. He said that for the past few days he'd been paying attention to how the caravan operated, and that he hadn't learned anything new. The only thing he'd noticed was that the talk of war was becoming more and more frequent. Then, one day, the boy returned the books to the Englishman.
"Did you learn anything?" the Englishman asked, eager to hear what it might be.
He needed someone to talk to, so as to avoid thinking about the possibility of war. "I learned that the world has a soul, and that whoever understands that soul can also understand the language of things. I learned that many alchemists realized their personal legends and wound up discovering the soul of the world, the Philosopher's Stone, and the Elixir of Life. But above all, I learned that these things are all so simple that they could be written on the surface of an emerald." The Englishman was disappointed. The years of research, the magic symbols, the strange words, and the laboratory equipment, none of this had made any impression on the boy. His soul must be too primitive to understand those things, he thought. He took back his books and packed them away again in their bags.
"Go back to watching the caravan," he said. "That didn't teach me anything either."
The boy went back to contemplating the silence of the desert and the sand raised by the animals. "Everyone has his or her own way of learning things," he said to himself. "His way isn't the same as mine, nor mine as his. But we're both in search of our personal legends, and I respect him for that." The caravan began to travel day and night. The hooded Bedouins reappeared more and more frequently, and the camel driver, who had become a good friend of the boys, explained that the war between the tribes had already begun. The caravan would be very lucky to reach the oasis. The animals were exhausted, and the men talked among themselves less and less. The silence was the worst aspect of the night, when the mere groan of a camel, which before had been nothing but the groan of a camel, now frightened everyone because it might signal a raid. The camel driver, though, seemed not to be very concerned with the threat of war. "I'm alive," he said to the boy as they ate a bunch of dates one night with no fires and no moon. "When I'm eating, that's all I think about. If I'm on the march, I just concentrate on marching. If I have to fight, it'll be just as good a day to die as any other. Because I don't live in either my past or my future, I'm interested only in the present. If you can concentrate always on the present, you'll be a happy man. You'll see that there is a life in the desert, that there are stars in the heavens, and that tribesmen fight because they are part of the human race. Life will be a party for you, a grand festival, because life is the moment we're living right now. Two nights later, as he was getting ready to bed down, the boy looked for the star they followed every night. He thought that the horizon was a bit lower than it had been, because he seemed to see stars on the desert itself.
"It's the oasis," said the camel driver.
"Well, why don't we go there right now?" the boy asked.
"Because we have to sleep."
The boy awoke as the sun rose. There, in front of him, where the small stars had been the night before, was an endless row of date palms stretching across the entire desert.
"We've done it," said the Englishman, who had also awakened early.
But the boy was quiet. He was at home with the silence of the desert, and he was content just to look at the trees. He still had a long way to go to reach the pyramids, and some day this morning would be just a memory. But this was the present moment, the party the camel driver had mentioned, and he wanted to live it as he did the lessons of his past and his dreams of the future. Although the vision of the date palms would some day be just a memory, right now it signified shade, water, and a refuge from the war. Yesterday the camel's groan signaled danger, and now a row of date palms could herald a miracle. The world speaks many languages, the boy thought.
The times rush past, and so do the caravans, thought the alchemist, as he watched the hundreds of people and animals arriving at the oasis. People were shouting at the new arrivals, dust obscured the desert sun, and the children of the oasis were bursting with excitement at the arrival of the strangers. The alchemist saw the tribal chiefs greet the leader of the caravan and converse with him at length. But none of that mattered to the alchemist. He'd already seen many people come and go, and the desert remained as it was. He'd seen kings and beggars walking the desert sands. The dunes were changed constantly by the wind, yet these were the same sands he had known since he was a child. He always enjoyed seeing the happiness that the travellers experienced when, after weeks of yellow sand and blue sky, they first saw the green of the date palms. Maybe God created the desert so that man could appreciate the date trees, he thought. He decided to concentrate on more practical matters. He knew that in the caravan there was a man to whom he was to teach some of his secrets. The omens had told him so. He didn't know the man yet, but his practiced eye would recognize him when he appeared. He hoped that it would be someone as capable as his previous apprentice. I don't know why these things have to be transmitted by word of mouth, he thought. It wasn't exactly that they were secrets. God revealed his secrets easily to all his creatures. He had only one explanation for this fact. Things have to be transmitted this way because they were made up from the pure life, and this kind of life cannot be captured in pictures or words. Because people become fascinated with pictures and words and wind up forgetting the language of the world. The boy couldn't believe what he was seeing. The oasis, rather than being just a well surrounded by a few palm trees, as he had seen once in a geography book, was much larger than many towns back in Spain. There were 300 wells, 50,000 date trees, and innumerable coloured tents spread among them.
"It looks like 1,001 nights, said the Englishman, impatient to meet with the alchemist.
They were surrounded by children, curious to look at the animals and people that were arriving. The men of the oasis wanted to know if they had seen any fighting, and the women competed with one another for access to the cloth and precious stones brought by the merchants. The silence of the desert was a distant dream. The travellers in the caravan were talking incessantly, laughing and shouting as if they had emerged from the spiritual world and found themselves once again in the world of people. They were relieved and happy. They had been taking careful precautions in the desert, but the camel driver explained to the boy that oases were always considered to be neutral territories because the majority of the inhabitants were women and children. There were oases throughout the desert, but the tribesmen fought in the desert, leaving the oases as places of refuge. With some difficulty, the leader of the caravan brought all his people together and gave them his instructions. The group was to remain there at the oasis until the conflict between the tribes was over. Since they were visitors, they would have to share living space with those who lived there and would be given the best accommodations. That was the law of hospitality. Then he asked that everyone, including his own sentinels, hand over their arms to the men appointed by the tribal chieftains.
"Those are the rules of war," the leader explained. "The oases may not shelter armies or troops."
To the boy's surprise, the Englishman took a chrome-plated revolver out of his bag and gave it to the men who were collecting the arms.
"Why a revolver?" he asked.
"It helped me to trust in people," the Englishman answered.
Meanwhile, the boy thought about his treasure. The closer he got to the realization of his dream, the more difficult things became. It seemed as if what the old king had called beginner's luck was no longer functioning. In his pursuit of the dream, he was being constantly subjected to tests of his persistence and courage. So he could not be hasty nor impatient. If he pushed forward impulsively, he would fail to see the signs and omens left by God along his path. "God placed them along my path," he had surprised himself with the thought. Until then, he had considered omens to be things of this world, like eating or sleeping, or like seeking love or finding a job. He'd never thought of them in terms of a language used by God to indicate what he should do. "Don't be impatient," he repeated to himself. "It's like the camel driver said, eat when it's time to eat, and move along when it's time to move along." That first day, everyone slept from exhaustion, including the Englishman. The boy was assigned a place far from his friend in a tent with five other young men of about his age. They were people of the desert and clamoured to hear his stories about the great cities. The boy told them about his life as a shepherd and was about to tell them of his experiences at the crystal shop when the Englishman came into the tent.
"I've been looking for you all morning," he said as he led the boy outside. "I need you to help me to find out where the alchemist lives."
First, they tried to find him on their own. An alchemist would probably live in a manner that was different from that of the rest of the people of the oasis, and it was likely that in his tent an oven was continuously burning. They searched everywhere and found that the oasis was much larger than they could have imagined. There were hundreds of tents.
"We've wasted almost the entire day," said the Englishman, sitting down with the boy near one of the wells.
"Maybe we'd better ask someone," the boy suggested. The Englishman didn't want to tell others about his reasons for being at the oasis and couldn't make up his mind, but finally he agreed that the boy who spoke better Arabic than he should do so. The boy approached a woman who had come to the well to fill a goatskin with water.
"Good afternoon, ma'am. I'm trying to find out where the alchemist lives here at the oasis."
The woman said she'd never heard of such a person and hurried away. But before she fled, she advised the boy that he had better not try to converse with women who were dressed in black, because they were married women. He should respect tradition. The Englishman was disappointed. It seemed he had made the long journey for nothing. The boy was also saddened. His friend was in pursuit of his personal legend, and when someone was in such a pursuit, the entire universe made an effort to help him succeed. That's what the old king had said. He couldn't have been wrong.
"I had never heard of alchemists before," the boy said. "Maybe no one here has either."
The Englishman's eyes lit up.
"That's it! Maybe no one here knows what an alchemist is. Find out who it is who cures the people's illnesses."
Several women dressed in black came to the well for water, but the boy would speak to none of them, despite the Englishman's insistence. Then a man approached.
"Do you know someone here who cures people's illnesses?" the boy asked.
Allah cures our illnesses, said the man, clearly frightened of strangers. You're looking for witch doctors.
He spoke some verses from the Quran and moved on. Another man appeared. He was older and was carrying a small bucket. The boy repeated his question.
Why do you want to find that sort of person? The Arab asked.
Because my friend here has travelled for many months in order to meet with him, the boy said.
If such a man is here at the oasis, he must be a very powerful one, said the old man after thinking for a few moments. Not even the tribal chieftains are able to see him when they want to, only when he consents. Wait for the end of the war, then leave with the caravan. Don't try to enter into the life of the oasis, he said,
and walked away.
But the Englishman was exultant. They were on the right track.
Finally, a young woman approached who was not dressed in black. She had a vessel on her shoulder, and her head was covered by a veil, but her face was uncovered. The boy approached her to ask about the alchemist. At that moment, it seemed to him that time stood still, and the soul of the world surged within him. When he looked into her dark eyes and saw that her lips were poised between a laugh and silence, he learned the most important part of the language that all the world spoke, the language that everyone on earth was capable of understanding in their heart. It was love, something older than humanity, more ancient than the desert, something that exerted the same force whenever two pairs of eyes met, as had theirs here at the well. She smiled, and that was certainly an omen, the omen he had been awaiting, without even knowing he was, for all his life. The omen he had sought to find with his sheep, and in his books, in the crystals, and in the silence of the desert. It was the pure language of the world. It required no explanation, just as the universe needs none as it travels through endless time. What the boy felt at that moment was that he was in the presence of the only woman in his life, and that, with no need for words, she recognized the same thing. He was more certain of it than of anything in the world. He had been told by his parents and grandparents that he must fall in love and really know a person before becoming committed. But maybe people who felt that way had never learned the universal language. Because when you know that language, it's easy to understand that someone in the world awaits you, whether it's in the middle of the desert or in some great city. And when two such people encounter each other and their eyes meet, the past and the future become unimportant. There is only that moment, and the incredible certainty that everything under the sun has been written by one hand only. It is the hand that evokes love and creates a twin soul for every person in the world. Without such love, one's dreams would have no meaning. Maktub, thought the boy. The Englishman shook the boy. Come on, ask her. The boy stepped closer to the girl, and when she smiled, he did the same. What's your name? He asked. Fatima, the girl said, averting her eyes. That's what some women in my country are called. It's the name of the Prophet's daughter, Fatima said. The invaders carried the name everywhere. The beautiful girl spoke of the invaders with pride. The Englishman prodded him, and the boy asked her about the man who cured people's illnesses. That's the man who knows all the secrets of the world, she said. He communicates with the genies of the desert. The genies were the spirits of good and evil, and the girl pointed to the south, indicating that it was there the strange man lived. Then she filled her vessel with water and left. The Englishman vanished too, gone to find the alchemist. And the boy sat there by the well for a long time, remembering that one day in Tarifa the Levanter had brought to him the perfume of that woman, and realizing that he had loved her before he even knew she existed. He knew that his love for her would enable him to discover every treasure in the world. The next day, the boy returned to the well, hoping to see the girl. To his surprise, the Englishman was there, looking out at the desert.
"I waited all afternoon and evening," he said. "He appeared with the first stars of evening. I told him what I was seeking, and he asked me if I had ever transformed lead into gold. I told him that was what I'd come here to learn. He told me I should try to do so. That's all he said. Go and try."
The boy didn't say anything. The poor Englishman had travelled all this way, only to be told that he should repeat what he had already done so many times. "So then try," he said to the Englishman.
"That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start now."
As the Englishman left, Fatima arrived and filled her vessel with water. "I came to tell you just one thing," the boy said. "I want you to be my wife. I love you." The girl dropped the container and the water spilled. "I'm going to wait here for you every day. I have crossed the desert in search of a treasure that is somewhere near the pyramids. And for me, the war seemed a curse. But now it's a blessing, because it brought me to you." "The war is going to end someday," the girl said. The boy looked around him at the date palms. He reminded himself that he had been a shepherd, and that he could be a shepherd again. Fatima was more important than his treasure. "The tribesmen are always in search of treasure," the girl said, as if she had guessed what he was thinking. "And the women of the desert are proud of their tribesmen." She refilled her vessel and left. The boy went to the well every day to meet with Fatima. He told her about his life as a shepherd, about the king, and about the crystal shop. They became friends. And except for the 15 minutes he spent with her, each day seemed that it would never pass. When he had been at the oasis for about a month, the leader of the caravan called a meeting of all the people travelling with him.
"We don't know when the war will end, so we can't continue our journey," he said. "The battles may last for a long time, perhaps even years. There are powerful forces on both sides, and the war is important to both armies. It's not a battle of good against evil, it's a war between forces that are fighting for the balance of power. And when that type of battle begins, it lasts longer than others, because Allah is on both sides." The people went back to where they were living, and the boy went to meet with Fatima that afternoon. He told her about the morning's meeting.
"The day after we met," Fatima said, "you told me that you loved me. Then you taught me something of the universal language and the soul of the world. Because of that, I have become a part of you." The boy listened to the sound of her voice and thought it to be more beautiful than the sound of the wind in the date palms. "I have been waiting for you here at this oasis for a long time. I have forgotten about my past, about my traditions, and the way in which men of the desert expect women to behave. Ever since I was a child, I have dreamed that the desert would bring me a wonderful present. Now my present has arrived, and it's you." The boy wanted to take her hand, but Fatima's hands held to the handles of her jug. "You have told me about your dreams, about the old king and your treasure, and you've told me about omens. So now I fear nothing, because it was those omens that brought you to me. I am a part of your dream, a part of your personal legend, as you call it. That's why I want you to continue toward your goal. If you have to wait until the war is over, then wait. But if you have to go before then, go on in pursuit of your dream. The dunes are changed by the wind, but the desert never changes. That's the way it will be with our love for each other." "Maktub," she said, "if I am really a part of your dream, you'll come back one day." The boy was sad as he left her that day. He thought of all the married shepherds he had known. They had a difficult time convincing their wives that they had to go off into distant fields. Love required them to stay with the people they loved. He told Fatima that at their next meeting. "The desert takes our men from us, and they don't always return," she said. "We know that, and we are used to it.
Those who don't return become a part of the clouds, a part of the animals that hide in the ravines, and of the water that comes from the earth. They become a part of everything. They become the soul of the world. Some do come back, and then the other women are happy because they believe that their men may one day return as well. I used to look at those women and envy them their happiness. Now I too will be one of the women who wait. I'm a desert woman, and I'm proud of that. I want my husband to wander as free as the wind that shapes the dunes. And if I have to, I will accept the fact that he's become a part of the clouds and the animals and the water of the desert. The boy went to look for the Englishman. He wanted to tell him about Fatima. He was surprised when he saw that the Englishman had built himself a furnace outside his tent. It was a strange furnace, fueled by firewood with a transparent flask heating on the top. As the Englishman stared out at the desert, his eyes seemed brighter than they had when he was reading his books.
"This is the first phase of the job," he said. "I have to separate out the sulphur. Now, to do that successfully, I must have no fear of failure. It was my fear of failure that first kept me from attempting the masterwork. Now I'm beginning what I could have started 10 years ago, but I'm happy at least that I didn't wait 20 years.
He continued to feed the fire, and the boy stayed on until the desert turned pink in the setting sun. He felt the urge to go out into the desert, to see if its silence held the answers to his questions. He wandered for a while, keeping the date palms of the oasis within sight. He listened to the wind and felt the stones beneath his feet. Here and there he found a shell and realized that the desert in remote times had been a sea. He sat on a stone and allowed himself to become hypnotized by the horizon. He tried to deal with the concept of love as distinct from possession and couldn't separate them. But Fatima was a woman of the desert, and if anything could help him to understand, it was the desert. As he sat there thinking, he sensed movement above him. Looking up, he saw a pair of hawks flying high in the sky. He watched the hawks as they drifted on the wind. Although their flight appeared to have no pattern, it made a certain kind of sense to the boy. It was just that he couldn't grasp what it meant. He followed the movement of the birds, trying to read something into it. Maybe these desert birds could explain to him the meaning of love without ownership. He felt sleepy. In his heart, he wanted to remain awake, but he also wanted to sleep. "I'm learning the language of the world, and everything in the world is beginning to make sense to me, even the flight of the hawks," he said to himself. And in that mood, he was grateful to be in love. When you're in love, things make even more sense, he thought. Suddenly, one of the hawks made a flashing dive through the sky, attacking the other. As it did so, a sudden, fleeting image came to the boy, an army, with its swords at the ready, riding into the oasis. The vision vanished immediately, but it had shaken him. He had heard people speak of mirages, and he had already seen some himself. They were desires that, because of their intensity, materialized over the sands of the desert. But he certainly didn't desire that an army invade the oasis. He wanted to forget about the vision and return to his meditation. He tried again to concentrate on the pink shades of the desert and its stones, but there was something there in his heart that wouldn't allow him to do so.
"Always heed the omens," the old king had said.
The boy recalled what he had seen in the vision and sensed that it was actually going to occur. He rose and made his way back toward the palm trees. Once again, he perceived the many languages and the things about him. This time, the desert was safe, and it was the oasis that had become dangerous. The camel driver was seated at the base of a palm tree, observing the sunset. He saw the boy appear from the other side of the dunes. "An army is coming," the boy said. "I had a vision."
"The desert fills men's hearts with visions," the camel driver answered.
But the boy told him about the hawks, that he had been watching their flight and had suddenly felt himself to have plunged to the soul of the world. The camel driver understood what the boy was saying. He knew that any given thing on the face of the earth could reveal the history of all things. One could open a book to any page, or look at a person's hand. One could turn a card, or watch the flight of the birds. Whatever the thing observed, one could find a connection with his experience of the moment. Actually, it wasn't that those things in themselves revealed anything at all. It was just that people, looking at what was occurring around them, could find a means of penetration to the soul of the world. The desert was full of men who earned their living based on the ease with which they could penetrate to the soul of the world. They were known as seers, and they were held in fear by women and the elderly. Tribesmen were also wary of consulting them because it would be impossible to be effective in battle if one knew that he was fated to die. The tribesmen preferred the taste of battle and the thrill of not knowing what the outcome would be. The future was already written by Allah, and what he had written was always for the good of man. So the tribesmen lived only for the present because the present was full of surprises, and they had to be aware of many things. Where was the enemy's sword? Where was his horse? What kind of blow should one deliver next in order to remain alive? The camel driver was not a fighter, and he had consulted with seers. Many of them had been right about what they said, while some had been wrong. Then one day, the oldest seer he had ever sought out, and the one most to be feared, had asked why the camel driver was so interested in the future.
"Well, so I can do things," he had responded, "and so I can change those things that I don't want to happen." "But then they wouldn't be part of your future," the seer had said. "Well, maybe I just want to know the future so I can prepare myself for what's coming." "If good things are coming, they will be a pleasant surprise," said the seer. "If bad things are, and you know in advance, you will suffer greatly before they even occur." "I want to know about the future because I'm a man," the camel driver had said to the seer. "And men always live their lives based on the future."
The seer was a specialist in the casting of twigs. He threw them on the ground and made interpretations based on how they fell. That day, he didn't make a cast. He wrapped the twigs in a piece of cloth and put them back in his bag.
"I make my living forecasting the future for people," he said. "I know the science of the twigs, and I know how to use them to penetrate to the place where all is written. There I can read the past, discover what has already been forgotten, and understand the omens that are here in the present. When people consult me, it's not that I'm reading the future, I am guessing at the future. The future belongs to God, and it is only he who reveals it under extraordinary circumstances. How do I guess at the future? Based on the omens of the present. The secret is here in the present. If you pay attention to the present, you can improve upon it. And if you improve on the present, what comes later will also be better. Forget about the future, and live each day according to the teachings, confident that God loves his children. Each day in itself brings with it an eternity."
The camel driver had asked what the circumstances were under which God would allow him to see the future.
"Only when he himself reveals it. And God only rarely reveals the future. When he does so, it is for only one reason. It's a future that was written so as to be altered."
God had shown the boy a part of the future, the camel driver thought. Why was it that he wanted the boy to serve as his instrument?
"Go and speak to the tribal chieftains," said the camel driver. "Tell them about the armies that are approaching."
"They'll laugh at me."
"No, they are men of the desert, and the men of the desert are used to dealing with omens."
"Well, then, they probably already know."
"They're not concerned with that right now. They believe that if they have to know about something Allah wants them to know, someone will tell them about it. It has happened many times before, but this time the person is you."
The boy thought of Fatima, and he decided he would go to see the chiefs of the tribes. The boy approached the guard at the front of the huge white tent at the center of the oasis. "I want to see the chieftains. I've brought omens from the desert."
Without responding, the guard entered the tent, where he remained for some time.
When he emerged, it was with a young Arab dressed in white and gold. The boy told the younger man what he had seen, and the man asked him to wait there. He disappeared into the tent. Night fell, and an assortment of fighting men and merchants entered and exited the tent. One by one, the campfires were extinguished, and the oasis fell as quiet as the desert. Only the lights in the great tent remained. During all this time, the boy thought about Fatima, and he was still unable to understand his last conversation with her. Finally, after hours of waiting, the guard bade the boy enter. The boy was astonished by what he saw inside. Never could he have imagined that here, in the middle of the desert, there existed a tent like this one. The ground was covered with the most beautiful carpets he'd ever walked upon, and from the top of the structure hung lamps of hand-wrought gold, each with a lighted candle. The tribal chieftains were seated at the back of the tent in a semicircle, resting upon richly embroidered silk cushions. Servants came and went with silver trays laden with spices and tea. Other servants maintained the fires in the hookahs. The atmosphere was suffused with the sweet scent of smoke. There were 8 chieftains, but the boy could see immediately which one of them was the most important. An Arab dressed in white and gold, seated at the center of the semicircle. At his side was the young Arab the boy had spoken with earlier.
"Who is this stranger who speaks of omens?" asked one of the chieftains, eyeing the boy.
"It is I," the boy answered, and he told what he had seen.
"Why would the desert reveal such things to a stranger when it knows that we have been here for generations?" said another of the chieftains.
"Because my eyes are not yet accustomed to the desert," the boy said. "I can see things that eyes habituated to the desert might not see." "And also because I know about the soul of the world," he thought to himself.
"The oasis is neutral ground. No one attacks an oasis," said the third chieftain.
"I can only tell you what I saw. If you don't want to believe me, you don't have to do anything about it." The men fell into animated discussion. They spoke in an Arab dialect the boy didn't understand, but when he made to leave, the guard told him to stay. The boy became fearful. The omens told him that something was wrong. He regretted having spoken to the camel driver about what he had seen in the desert. Suddenly, the elder at the center smiled almost imperceptibly, and the boy felt better. The man hadn't participated in the discussion, and in fact hadn't said a word up to that point. But the boy was already used to the language of the world, and he could feel the vibrations of peace throughout the tent. Now his intuition was that he'd been right in coming. The discussion ended. The chieftains were silent for a few moments as they listened to what the old man was saying. Then he turned to the boy. This time his expression was cold and distant.
2,000 years ago, in a distant land, a man who believed in dreams was thrown into a dungeon and then sold as a slave," the old man said, now in the dialect the boy understood. "Our merchants bought that man and brought him to Egypt. All of us know that whoever believes in dreams also knows how to interpret them."
The elder continued,
"When the Pharaoh dreamed of cows that were thin and cows that were fat, this man I'm speaking of rescued Egypt from famine. His name was Joseph. He too was a stranger in a strange land like you, and he was probably about your age."
He paused, and his eyes were still unfriendly.
"We always observe the tradition. The tradition saved Egypt from famine in those days and made the Egyptians the wealthiest of peoples. The tradition teaches men how to cross the desert and how their children should marry. The tradition says that an oasis is neutral territory because both sides have oases, and so both are vulnerable."
No one said a word as the old man continued.
"But the tradition also says that we should believe the messages of the desert. Everything we know was taught to us by the desert."
The old man gave a signal, and everyone stood. The meeting was over. The hookahs were extinguished and the guards stood at attention. The boy made ready to leave, but the old man spoke again.
Tomorrow we are going to break the agreement that says no one at the Oasis may carry arms. Throughout the entire day, we will be on the lookout for our enemies. When the sun sets, the men will once again surrender their arms to me. For every 10 dead men among our enemies, you will receive a piece of gold. But arms cannot be drawn unless they also go into battle. Arms are as capricious as the desert, and if they are not used, the next time they might not function. If at least one of them hasn't been used by the end of the day tomorrow, one will be used on you. When the boy left the tent, the oasis was illuminated only by the light of the full moon. He was 20 minutes from his tent and began to make his way there. He was alarmed by what had happened. He had succeeded in reaching through to the soul of the world, and now the price for having done so might be his life. It was a frightening bet, but he had been making risky bets ever since the day he had sold his sheep to pursue his personal legend. As the camel driver had said, to die tomorrow was no worse than dying on any other day. Every day was there to be lived or to mark one's departure from this world. Everything depended on one word, Maktub. Walking along in the silence, he had no regrets. If he died tomorrow, it would be because God was not willing to change the future. He would at least have died after having crossed the strait, after having worked in a crystal shop, and after having known the silence of the desert and Fatima's eyes. He had lived every one of his days intensely since he had left home so long ago. If he died tomorrow, he would already have seen more than other shepherds, and he was proud of that. Suddenly, he heard a thundering sound, and he was thrown to the ground by a wind such as he had never known. The area was swirling in dust so intense that it hid the moon from view. Before him was an enormous white horse, rearing over him with a frightening scream. When the blinding dust had settled a bit, the boy trembled at what he saw. Astride the animal was a horseman dressed completely in black, with a falcon perched on his left shoulder. He wore a turban, and his entire face, except for his eyes, were covered with a black kerchief. He appeared to be a messenger from the desert, but his presence was much more powerful than that of a mere messenger. The strange horseman drew an enormous curved sword from a scabbard mounted on his saddle. The steel of its blade glittered in the light of the moon.
"Who dares to read the meaning of the flight of the hawks?" he demanded, so loudly that his words seemed to echo through the 50,000 palm trees of Al-Fayyum.
"It is I who dare to do so," said the boy. He was reminded of the image of Santiago Matamoros, mounted on his white horse with the infidels beneath his hooves. This man looked exactly the same, except that now the roles were reversed. "It is I who dared to do so," he repeated, and he lowered his head to receive a blow from the sword. "Many lives will be saved because I was able to see through to the soul of the world." The sword didn't fall. Instead, the stranger lowered it slowly until the point touched the boy's forehead. It drew a droplet of blood. The horseman was completely immobile, as was the boy. It didn't even occur to the boy to flee. In his heart, he felt a strange sense of joy. He was about to die in pursuit of his personal legend. And for Fatima. The omens had been true after all. Here he was, face to face with his enemy. But there was no need to be concerned about dying. The soul of the world awaited him, and he would soon be a part of it. And tomorrow, his enemy would also be a part of that soul. The stranger continued to hold the sword at the boy's forehead.
"Why did you read the flight of the birds?"
"I read only what the birds wanted to tell me. They wanted to save the oasis. Tomorrow, all of you will die, because there are more men at the oasis than you have."
The sword remained where it was.
"Who are you to change what Allah has willed?"
"Allah created the armies, and he also created the hawks. Allah taught me the language of the birds,
Everything has been written by the same hand, the boy said, remembering the camel driver's words. The stranger withdrew the sword from the boy's forehead, and the boy felt immensely relieved, but he still couldn't flee.
Be careful with your prognostications, said the stranger. When something is written, there is no way to change it.
All I saw was an army, said the boy. I didn't see the outcome of the battle. The stranger seemed satisfied with the answer, but he kept the sword in his hand.
What is a stranger doing in a strange land?
I'm following my personal legend. It's not something you would understand. The stranger placed his sword in its scabbard, and the boy relaxed.
I had to test your courage, the stranger said. Courage is the quality most essential to understanding the language of the world.
The boy was surprised. The stranger was speaking of things very few people knew about.
You must not let up, even after having come so far, he continued. You must love the desert, but never trust it completely. Because the desert tests all men. It challenges every step and kills those who become distracted.
What he said reminded the boy of the old king.
If the warriors come here, and your head is still on your shoulders at sunset, come and find me, said the stranger.
The same hand that had brandished the sword now held a whip. The horse reared again, raising a cloud of dust. Where do you live? Shouted the boy as the horseman rode away. The hand with the whip pointed to the south. The boy had met the alchemist.